On April 4, Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan announced his Path to Prosperity plan that has generated a firestorm of controversy, putting it at the center of international debate. You've been a prophet, you've been called a prophet and a pariah. You must feel like, though, a pinata. So it's 6 weeks later, so it's a good time to talk about your plan. Let's get into it this way. Since you announced it April 4, a couple things have happened. President Obama answered with his plan. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you about that. And then just last week, the projection came out, Medicare is going to be insolvent 5 years earlier,
right.
2024 instead of 2029. So talk to us about the last 6 weeks and the response to your plan, even though you got it passed by the U.S. House. And thanks for doing the interview.
You bet. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you again. Number one, I guess that means profit, because we knew these entitlement programs like Medicare were going bankrupt. The president didn't actually come out with a plan. He came out with a speech. I would say that the speech was more about politics than policy.
He laid down some markers.
He laid down some markers, and he laid out one idea, which was to take his independent payment advisory board, this price control board that he appoints for Medicare, and have them double their current cuts to Medicare for current seniors. Right. So that's about what he put out there. The key is we need to have this conversation in America. If we want to avert a debt crisis, preempt a debt crisis, and if we want to do it on our terms as Americans, meaning like we propose to hold current seniors harmless, keep the promise that government has been making to people in and near retirement, we got to fix these programs now. If we keep kicking the can down the road, if we keep delaying and allowing this demagoguery to produce the kind of political paralysis that is dominated in Washington, then all bets are off and current retirees are going to get cut. They're going to get hurt. And so that's the point we're trying to make. What I'm trying to do, I guess you could say in a prophetic way, is get this country ahead of the crisis and prevent a crisis from happening. Because the kind of crisis we would have if we do have a debt crisis would be worse than the financial collapse in 2008, according to many economists, many observers. We see it coming. We see what Europe is going through. We don't need that here. And what we're trying to do is do the responsible thing, the adult thing, have an honest conversation. And we got to get through all these politics, and that's unfortunate, is both political parties do this to each other, scare seniors. They like to use that as a political weapon for the next election. Unfortunately, if we allow that to continue to occur or to be effective, then what happens is we will have bankruptcy, and then seniors will get cut, and that's what we're trying to avoid.
In the 6 weeks since you put the plan out there, have we had an honest dialogue, or have we had more of the scare of politics?
More of the scare of politics, which I fully expected. I've been doing this for a number of years, as you know, Steve. I've had different versions of these kinds of things.
Last time we did this, you gave me a huge thing to read.
That's right.
I read most of it.
Thank you. I hope you read this, because if you go to budget.house.gov, we wrote it in a very digestible way. We wrote it in English. Budgets aren't always written in English. We wrote this budget in English so people could see what it is precisely that we're proposing. We haven't gotten to that adult level of conversation. I saw a television ad the other day that literally shows a dramatization of me shoving an elderly woman off a cliff in a wheelchair. That I would not call an adult conversation. So the debate is sinking to new lows, but nevertheless, we need to press forward on this thing. And I believe, from doing the 19 town hall meetings I did around southern Wisconsin just prior few weeks, that people are hungry for solutions. They're hungry for political leaders to address the crises of the day and not run for the hills or just demagogue and just go into base old-time politics.
But you want to reinvent a plan that provides health care for 48 million Americans. Very emotional idea. Can it be sold rationally and not in the charge and countercharge of politics, Congressman?
If it can't be, then it goes bankrupt. That's the problem. Here's the issue. Medicare, the status quo, not only is the status quo unsustainable, the status quo is gone because of the president's health care law. What people don't realize is the president's board starts next year. He appoints the 15 people to this board in the current law, and he gives them cutting targets, about $500 billion now. And in his speech, he wants to add more to it and have them price control Medicare for current seniors. So already we are seeing that Medicare, as we have known it, has already been changed dramatically under the president's health care law. We want to get rid of this board. We want to keep the program intact for people 55 and above, but in order to be able to do that, you have to reform it for those of us who are 54 and below, and the way in which we choose to reform it, that we propose to reform it, is a way that's proven to work very successfully where it's been tested. The prescription drug program works this way. Medicare Advantage looks like this. People have different plans when they buy their Medicare supplemental insurance. Mm-hmm. It works like the same kind of a system that members of Congress have. It's the recommendation of Bill Clinton's 1999 Bipartisan Commission to Save Medicare. So these aren't new ideas, and these are ideas that have historically had bipartisan origins, and we think these ideas have been proven to succeed. And the whole difference is between our approach and the president's is we want to give future seniors the power to deny care, to deny business to inefficient providers. The president's plan wants to give the power to the government to deny care to seniors, and that's a big difference.
That's what you're referring to in your speech to the Economic Club of Chicago when you said, give a board of 15 unelected bureaucrats in Washington the power to deeply ration health care. This would disrupt the lives of those currently in retirement and lead to waiting lists for today's seniors?
Yes. It's 1997 did this. Now, the 1997 budget agreement, which was bipartisan, President Clinton signed it, put a lot of price controls in Medicare. And what we found was it wasn't working, and Medicare providers were just dropping Medicare patients or going out of business. So in two subsequent bills, Congress restored that money. So the lesson that the president, this current president, chose to learn from that was take the control out of the hands of Congress. Give it to an unelected board and let them put the price controls in place without Congress's consent and make that happen so it can stick. What that means is we will repeat the kinds of mistakes we made back in 1997. Physicians know what the SGR, the sustainable growth rate, is. These are the cuts to physician payments, which are now encouraging physicians to drop Medicare patients. We're going to do more of that under this board, and that's what the board's tasked to do. But this time, according to the president's plan, Congress has nothing to do with it. And so I just don't think price controls is the solution to Medicare. It will end up rationing, it will end up creating waiting lists, and it will encourage providers to drop Medicare patients. And that's what the chief actuary of Medicare is telling us. Chief actuary of Medicare came to the budget committee and said that by the end of the decade, under this scheme, Medicare will be reimbursing providers at rates lower than Medicaid. And what we find with Medicaid is a lot of providers just don't take it anymore.
I understand in the last 24 hours there's been a trial balloon floated. Make participation in your program for Medicare optional. Is that anything that's got any possibility?
Sure, it does. And I've always said from our first press conference that we are establishing a framework. And those types of details are clearly reasonable and negotiable items. What some of the people who have advocated that idea are saying is allow a capped amount to go to the traditional Medicare system alongside the premium support system so they compete with one another on an equal basis. I've always said that that's a fine idea worth considering. This is not a etched-in-stone plan. It's a budget resolution. The actual legislating would occur if we actually had a budget process that was continuing, and that's clearly a detail that I think should be discussed and debated. My concern right now, though, is it looks like the Senate's not going to pass a budget. And if the Senate doesn't pass a budget, then the entire budget process stops. And no reform continues.
Well, one other part of your plan would give governors more of a choice over providing their health care to the elderly, poor, and disabled.
You're talking about Medicaid now.
Medicaid now. I've gone to Medicaid. Thank you for the clarification. That would save $750 billion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that set up then governors as officials determining, wouldn't they ration health care?
No, because we've met with governors, we've met with a number of governors who asked us for this freedom, which is we will continue to grow Medicaid, but at more of a sustainable pace, because Medicaid is going bankrupt as well as Medicare. It's growing at unsustainable rates.
Which one's going bankrupt quicker?
Well, Medicaid is measured differently than Medicare because it's a joint state-federal program. Medicare is the biggest unfunded liability to the federal government, tens of trillions of dollars of unfunded liability.
Biggest time bomb out there.
It's the biggest time bomb out there. Second to that is Medicaid, but it also is stressing state budgets. And so what we're saying to governors is we will give you your Medicaid allotment in block grants. That's what waivers do today. I mean, Badger Care is a waiver program. I fought for those waivers for Badger Care, which is essentially like a block grant. SCHIP, the State Children's Health Insurance Program,
right,
that's a block grant that is customized by the states. So the states like these block grants. The states are good at customizing these programs. So we're saying let's go down that path. Let states customize their health care to meet the particular needs of their populations. Let's make sure this money goes to that Medicare, Medicaid population. They can't take it and rate it for something else. But give the states the freedom and the flexibility to take this money, which grows every year with inflation plus population growth, so that they can customize it. So it saves the money. It saves money for the federal government and makes it more sustainable, so we can afford to keep the program continuing. But it gives the states the kinds of freedoms to customize these programs. Look, it took years to get these waivers for Badger Care. We shouldn't have to go through that kind of an episode. I believe that Scott Walker and Dennis Smith, who are capable health care reformers, Dennis Smith ran the Medicaid program for the federal government for years. He's the Secretary of Health and Human Services here in Wisconsin, of DHS. I believe we ought to give them the innovation, the tools to actually make Medicaid a better program for Wisconsinites.
So 6 weeks after rolling out your plan, you're convinced it's still the best idea out there?
You know why? No other idea has been put out there.
Okay.
There has not been a plan put by the President or by the Senate Democrats to actually tackle this challenge. Our bill does four things. It works on economic growth policies to create jobs. It repairs the social safety net so that we can keep it and so that we can get people back to work. It fulfills the mission of health and retirement security and brings solvency to these programs like Medicare and Medicaid. And it literally, over time, pays off our national debt. No other plan has been introduced by the Senate or by the President that does anything close to achieving that.
But many of your critics focus on your cutting of tax rates from 35 to 25%. Mm-hmm. That part of it?
We do that on a revenue neutral basis. That's what the President's bipartisan fiscal commission recommended as well. That was supported by a majority of Democrats. And so what we're saying is take away the tax shelters and the tax deductions and lower tax rates. It is the wealthiest and the largest corporations that enjoy all the tax shelters in America. So if you take away the tax shelters and lower tax rates on everybody, you get a better tax code that is fairer, flatter, simpler, and more internationally competitive, so our employers, our job creators, aren't taxed more than their foreign competitors are.
You take away any of those tax breaks on charities and homes?
That's something that will be decided by Ways and Means Committee. We have much more wiggle room under the tax base broadening than, say, the fiscal commission, because our revenue line is targeted at the historic average, not as a much higher average. What I'm trying to say is there is room to keep the more broader-based tax deductions for individuals under our plan. And as the summer goes on, those kinds of hearings and research is what the Ways and Means Committee is going to be doing.
In your speech in Chicago, you said this. I want to ask you about it. To begin with, chasing ever higher spending with ever higher tax rates will decrease the number of makers in society and increase the number of takers. Explain makers versus takers, please, Congressman.
So we have all these statistics that are now flowing into the government that are showing that more and more people are net dependents on the federal government. They're getting more benefits from the federal government in dollar terms than they're contributing in taxes. We don't want to have a society where able-bodied people are dependent upon the government for their livelihoods, because that's a society that breeds complacency and dependency that ends up lulling people into lives of complacency. We don't want to drain people of their incentive and will to make the most of their lives. And this is why we're calling for retooling the welfare safety net, to gear it not toward keeping people on welfare, but getting people back to work. One of the things we propose is to consolidate the myriad of job training programs that come out of Washington. 49 different programs from 9 different agencies. We don't even measure whether they work very well. Mm-hmm. We want to consolidate them into career scholarships so that a person who loses their job, who's in an industry that went away, like around here, auto, that gives them the ability to take that scholarship, go to a Black Hawk Tech, go to an MATC, go to a Gateway, go to Parkside, UW, go to Madison, learn a new skill, get a degree so they can get back into a career, back into a life that's promising and flourishing, and on to a life of self-sufficiency. So what we're trying to say is we've got to retool our safety net system to get people back on their feet and not to lull them into dependency.
The Wall Street Journal said your plan would also add $5 trillion to the debt. But I think your answer is that
the President adds $13 trillion to the debt.
So 13 minus five is...
Yeah, so here's the issue. Anytime you run a deficit in any year, you're adding to the debt. It took us years to get into the hole that we are in, and it's going to take us years to climb out of this hole. The reason we still run some deficits, the reason we still borrow money, is because we believe we can afford to do this because what we want to do is keep current seniors intact. The government made a promise to senior citizens who retired and organized their lives around these promises. People who are about to retire, within 10 years of retiring, are forming their entire retirements around these promises.
Yes, the entitlements.
The entitlements. And so what we're saying is, we believe we can cash flow this promise now if we reform them for the next generation and get the debt stabilized and the debt under control. If we don't put these kinds of reforms in, then that means we will never stabilize our debt, and that means we will have a debt crisis, and that means everybody will get cut. And so what we're trying to do here is to say, look, let's keep this promise to people who've organized their lives around it, but in order to afford to keep that promise, You got to reform these programs for my generation, which, by the way, we won't have these benefits if we keep going down the path we're on. So let's make it more secure for us so we have something to count on. But more importantly, reform these things so we stabilize the debt so we can afford to give our parents and grandparents the kind of benefits that they organize their lives around.
Critics also say your plan doesn't do much on the Pentagon and defense spending. Your answer?
We take $79 billion out of the Pentagon. Actually, we take $178 billion out of the Pentagon.
Over what period?
Over a five-year period. And we take $100 to go toward the troops. Because we've got a two-front war, we're burning through a lot of equipment, a lot of supplies. So we put $100 billion toward the troops to give them what they needed. But then we take $78 billion for deficit reduction. I would love nothing more than to budget for peacetime, to have a peace dividend. The problem is we're not at peace. The world is becoming a more dangerous place, not a more peaceful place. And so we do cut the Pentagon, and we do dedicate savings for deficit reduction. But I don't want to cut beyond the meat, beyond the fat into the meat and the bone and make it a more dangerous operation. I don't want to have a system where we are shortcutting our troops and we're shortcutting the missions that we've already launched, that the president has already committed us to.
How did you pick age 55? Because I'm okay, but your kids' generation?
I picked it because it is, for now, we can afford it. It's 10 years away from retiring. But I got to tell you, the way the numbers work, every year you delay, we go about $10 trillion deeper into the hole on unfunded liabilities. And then you won't be able to make it 55 and above. That age number will go up and up and up the more we delay to reform these programs. And that's the whole point. If the demagoguery and the political tactic to scare senior citizens actually succeeds politically, you know, the irony of all this, then those seniors will actually get hurt. And so we can do 55 and above now, but if we keep kicking the can down the road, that's not going to be the case much longer.
One of the things your plan does is take on farm subsidies, $30 billion in farm subsidies.
Yeah. We think
Excuse
we should
me, you represent state of Wisconsin.
I do. We think we should reform the direct payment program and the crop insurance program. A lot of these subsidies go to very, very wealthy corporate farms. I've always been for means testing our farm programs. We should not be giving farm support payments to firms or individuals, you know, making over $250,000 a year. Most of the money goes to people in companies that make more than that a year in income. And I just don't think we should be subsidizing that.
There's another term in your speech in Chicago, crony capitalism. Mm-hmm. What is that, sir?
Let me give you the best example of crony capitalism that we've seen this week. Picking winners and losers in the marketplace based on political power, political access. The waivers from Obamacare that we've seen. Harry Reid got a partial waiver for his state and his constituents in Nevada. Nancy Pelosi got waivers for some of her constituents and supporters in San Francisco. This means having the government going through and picking winners and losers in the marketplace. It's sort of like replacing the rule of law, which is a founding principle of this democracy,
yes,
with the rule of elites, with the rule of men, with the rule of political access. That, to me, is very devastating toward our democracy. It's devastating toward our economy. And we should not have a system where we give so much power to the federal government, and then we allow a handful of people in the federal government to determine who wins and who loses based upon decisions they make in Washington. That should be determined by the marketplace. That should be determined by a person's work ethic, by a person's ideas, by a person's achievement, not by some distant politician or bureaucrat in Washington giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
I found your speech interesting in one more aspect. 1,000 businesses have been waived out.
Yeah, now it's actually higher than that. We've since got some more disclosure that it's even higher than that.
Are those large or small businesses, Congressman?
They're small businesses in Nancy Pelosi's district, large businesses around, and McDonald's. Most of them are large businesses and unions.
And that means what? If they don't have to comply with the terms of healthcare reform?
That means for 1 year they don't have to comply and then they have to go back for waivers. But if you're a small business, if you don't have the political clout to get the waiver, you have to face these onerous mandates and taxes.
You've seen the studies. Baby boomers, how many of them are there? Are 70 million?
Well, we go from 40 million to 77 million when they're fully retired, so 77 million,
right.
10,000 a day are retiring.
A low percentage of them have got enough money to save for their golden years.
Yes.
What does this country look like when boomers are 80, 85, and they don't have, and their savings run out?
This is why we're saying, let's fix this problem now, so those who are in or near retirement, people 55 and above, don't have the rug pulled out from under them. so we can keep these benefits as they're currently designed the retirement around. But in order to cash flow that promise, you have to reform these programs for my generation. And those of us who are younger will have better time to prepare for our retirements. There's no way Medicare will continue for my generation like it is today. The president's healthcare law already changes that. So isn't it better to give people lead time and warning about what the program will look like, make it a program they can actually count on, and then prepare for?
New York Times says your plan poses huge political risks for Republican candidates for Congress and for the candidates for the White House. Has this come into play in the special election for?
Well, I think the special election in New York is more a third-party Tea Party candidate. That's kind of a spoiler there.
Okay.
But if they're successful at demagoguing and scaring seniors, then sure, it's a political weapon that will be successful in pushing elections. Here's the problem. If we allow that to happen in this country, then we're simply signing on to Medicare going bankrupt. Then we're signing on to a debt crisis, a financial collapse, and then we're signing on to doing bitter austerity, which is cuts that are rapid and sudden for those who depend on government the most, the elderly and the poor. That's the kind of thing we're trying to prevent from happening. And so do you create a political weapon that, if distorted and demagogued, can give your opponents a powerful political tool against you? Yes. But that's not what leaders do. Leaders don't back away from that. Leaders try to fix what's wrong, try to go to the people with honest, sensible solutions, and try and explain these to people about why this is necessary. That's what I'm trying to do.
The latest presidential candidate to say he didn't like your plan, of course, was Newt Gingrich. Now, has he spoken to apologize for his right-wing social engineering?
He has. He called me to apologize, and he said he misspoke. It wasn't an accurate comment. It is a grossly inaccurate statement. He knows that. He realizes that he misspoke, and he has since apologized about that.
Well, but looking out, there's going to be a presidential election next year. Mm-hmm. Which of the candidates that are out there are saying are coming the closest to debating your issues?
I don't know yet because the field hasn't fully materialized yet. I think some other people might get in the race, and we'll see.
Would you like to see Mitch Daniels?
I think Mitch would be a great addition to the field. And we'll see I think we'll know in a handful of days, if not a week or two, whether he gets in the race or not.
Is Gingrich qualified to be president, Congressman?
Sure, he's qualified. He was Speaker of the House for a number of years. Of course, he's qualified to be president.
Let's talk about the looming August 2nd. We run out of we hit the debt ceiling.
Right.
What's going to be your role in that dialogue? Because that's our next crisis.
Right. So the role of the Ways and Means Committee is actually in charge of the debt limit legislation. If there are budget reforms that accompany the debt limit, that's what the Budget Committee produces.
Okay.
So my role is budget process reforms and controls and scorekeeping, meaning budget estimates for the kinds of spending cuts we get in exchange for the debt limit increase.
Okay, but do you see do you see it getting worked out prior to August 2nd? Is there going to be another tick, 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 we're up against midnight on August 2?
That can happen. Unfortunately, that is the way Washington works. My guess is it will probably be resolved before then, but it will probably take the bulk of this summer, meaning June and July, to work this out. We've basically said something very simple, which is for every dollar the president wants to increase the debt limit, we've got to cut more than a dollar's worth of spending. The president wants a $2 trillion increase in the debt limit. We have offered $6.2 trillion in spending cuts. So there's plenty of things we put out there to choose from, because the whole point here is we've got to get this debt stabilized. If we just rubber stamp an increase in the debt limit, then the credit markets will conclude that the Americans can't get their situation under control, and they will charge us a whole lot more money to lend us their money. That means our interest rates go up. That means we have an inflation problem, slows down our economy. So this is serious because it matters to our economy right now and economic growth. We need a sizable and material down payment on our debt and deficits as a consequence of raising the debt limit so we can buy more time with the credit markets, so we can stabilize interest rates and get this economy growing.
Was there any meaningful spending cuts in the package that keeps the federal government running this year?
You talk about the continuing resolution?
Yes,
the savings don't materialize unless you really carry it out for the next fiscal year.
Okay. So, what's the status of your plan 6 weeks later? Is it still?
We're waiting for the Senate. So here's the way the process works. The House.
Senate is Democrats.
Right. So, but if they can't pass a budget, then we don't have a conference to conference our differences. It just stops. If they're incapable of passing a budget, then the system stops. That's the problem. And then I think what will happen is we focus more on debt limit negotiations and what kind of budget reforms, what kind of piecemeal agreements we can get as part of that.
What have the last 6 weeks been like for you? I mean, you meet the press.
Fairly predictable, only that I knew if you put out bold ideas and bold solutions to, right. to the problems and address entitlements, you're going to get demagogued. You're going to have these kinds of political attacks. I still believe we need to press ahead on this because I think America, I think the country wants to be talked to like adults. If anything from my town hall meetings tells me anything, which was they were overwhelmingly supportive, they want leaders to confront problems before they get out of our control. And I feel so vindicated from my town hall meetings, from talking to my constituents, the people I represent, that that's exactly what they want to see us doing, and that is what we're doing.
What's been the worst, most unfair criticism of your plan?
Oh, I'd have to give that one some thought.
What's been the best and most fair?
I guess the TV ad of me pushing a woman, an elderly woman in a wheelchair off a cliff. I think that's probably the worst political tack. That one just takes the cake.
Who ran that?
I can't remember the name of the group that ran that. Do you know? I don't know.
Okay. You made a decision this week. You're not in for the U.S. Senate.
Right.
You want to stay representing the First
District
of Wisconsin?
Yeah, I can do more where I am. As I'm chairman of the Budget Committee, I'm a senior member of the Ways and Means Committee. I have so much more seniority accrued in the House where I have a stronger impact on public policy. For me to get in the Senate where I am in the House would take me 12 to 18 years. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in Congress. So I just feel like I can do so much more where I am than if I started over from scratch in the Senate, which is more of a pure seniority-based system.
You don't want to spend the rest of your life in Congress?
I don't want to spend the rest of my life in Congress.
Vice President? President?
Who knows? Those aren't things I have my mind focused on. I think I can do more where I am right now. I believe I helped start a conversation in this country about what we need to do to save the country, and I don't want to walk away from that conversation. And I think I'm in a good place to do that.
Who would be the best candidates to run for Herb Kohl's seat from your party?
Oh, we've got plenty of good candidates. You've got Tommy, you've got Ted Kanavas, you've got J.B. Van Hollen, you've got the Fitz brothers. I think Mark Newman's thinking about it. There are a lot of good qualified candidates who would be more than capable of taking this seat.
Any of them you want to say put at the head of the
list? It's way too soon to get into that. I think, no, the way I look at it is, you support the party-endorsed candidate or the nominee, whichever comes first.
Okay, then I guess my final question. Talk to me about your hometown. How's Janesville doing post-GM?
We still have high unemployment here. One of the good things we have is we get a great technical college here, Black Hawk Tech. A lot of my high school buddies worked at GM, have gone to Black Hawk, and have gotten some pretty good degrees to get into good professions. So a lot of people went to St. Louis. A lot of people went to Indiana within GM based on seniority. One of my friends is down in St. Louis during the weekdays and then comes home on the weekends to keep her seniority going to get her benefits. So we've seen a lot of people in Janesville leave either temporarily or permanently. A bunch of people went to Arlington permanently. Another buddy of mine from my church went to Arlington down there.
Texas?
Texas, Arlington, Texas. That's where they make Tahoes and Suburbans. So, okay. So we've had a bit of population leave the city, which is unfortunate. We have seen some good entrepreneurial growth. We have seen some good entrepreneurs get back on their feet and start creating jobs out in our business parks and in small job increments, but we have not had the kind of economic development. And I think that's more of a symptom of the broader state and the broader economy. I keep making phone calls to larger businesses to see if they could come and take over the GM plant and make something here. Mm-hmm. The conversation typically goes like this. Not in this economy, not with the uncertainty that I have out there with what government taxes and regulations are doing. So it's not the kind of economy where a large business is willing to commit large capital to create a large, a job base, like taking over a GM plant. That's been our problem. It's the broader macroeconomic problems. But the key here is we have the best, most educated workforce that GM had. I mean, literally, the Janesville workers were the most productive, the best workers in all of GM. And so we have a great selling point here. We have a very productive, very educated, hardworking workforce here in Janesville. So it's a great marketing tool. We're recruiting companies from Illinois and from around, but we need the broader economy to grow. We need economic growth in America so we can get this kind of thing going.
Well, Paul Ryan, thanks for the update. Are we going to keep following your career on Meet the Press and MSNBC
we'll see.
And
I guess so.
All that?
All right.
Thank you very much.
You bet.